Good evening. You are very welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and my co-host, you can hear in the background, is Juno the Jack Russell. I do apologise. It is the joys of recording a radio show from home. But I hope you are safe and well as you tune in this evening and that you had a fantastic week. Now, what have I got lined up for you on today's show? Well, we're going to be talking about turf or the peat or the bog or whatever it is you want to call it. And don't switch off, because I know we've all gotten a bit browned off about this particular argument over the past couple of weeks. So I want to do something a little bit different. We're not going to talk about turf cutting. We're not going to be talking about the rights and wrongs of it or where we stand in it. We want to talk about the bogs and what the bogs mean to us. And to do that, we are joined by PhD candidate Jamie Rowhugh. Jamie is not a Midlands man. He's a West Cork man. We'll have to forgive you now for the Cork connection. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Aisling.
Now, Jamie, let us, I suppose, start things off for us. You're a PhD candidate and you are looking at the bogs for your PhD. So where did this interest come from to begin with?
Oh, that's a great question. So I did a business degree and I went to a talk one evening at that during my degree, and Duncan Stewart, the well-known broadcaster, gave a talk that evening about the environment. And after that, you know, it was a very informative discussion, but it also made me realize how important the environment is and the need to protect it. So that was about 2010, 2011. And after that, I wanted to study the environment. So as I finished my degree, I looked at some postgraduate courses and I ended up doing a master's degree where I looked at Bordermona and what they did with their bogs once they were finished cutting them. So what happens with a cutaway bog? So I did that, and then I decided I wanted to continue on in academia, and I went looking for a PhD that built upon my master's work, and that's how I ended up in the geography department in Trinity College, and I'm now nearing the end of my final year, and hopefully by June we'll be finished and I'll have a thesis ready to go, where that covers basically what the just transition is for the bogs. So what does that look like? So building across,
yeah, so on the cutaway. Like, I know, Jamie, you've been working now for several years on this PhD, and you will, your dissertation at the end, I suppose, will be several thousand pages long, nearly, or several hundred pages long at least. But in a nutshell, what are you examining as part of your PhD?
So people will be familiar with the idea of just transition at the moment. I mean, this just transition for workers and I suppose for communities. I wanted to inquire what that actually meant for people in the Midlands who were living that reality. So what did just transition mean to a Bordermona briquette factory worker, or a Bordermona peat harvester, or a person who was living across the road from a briquette factory and had a business and the briquette factory closed? What does the just transition mean for them? So I looked at how transition was actioned in the past. And, you know, if any of your listeners are familiar with Bordermona, the idea that job loss just happens at the moment is incorrect. Like, there has been jobs lost in Bordermona since the late 80s, and the workforce has been reducing over that time. So just transition and the idea that this closure is happening at the moment, this isn't really the reality for a lot of people. It's been going on for years. So I sat down with shopkeepers, I've sat down with publicans, I've sat down with scientists, I've asked them, and I've tried to understand what just transition actually means for these people and the vision they have for the future of the bogs in which they live in and around. And I did work too with turf cutters, and I spent time with them out on their bogs and asked them about, you know, their lives and what transition meant to them and how they had experienced transition when the National Parks and Wildlife Service came in and said, this is a special area of conservation and you can't cut anymore. So there was I suppose my work was very much focused on what happened in the past, what's going to happen in the future. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen in the future, but really asking people what they wanted and their vision for the future. And hopefully my findings will inform policy in the future. Perhaps that's a little ambitious, but the voices of people need to be heard. The people that live in these parts of Ireland, you know, they need to have their opinions shared. And it's not just about scientists or people in universities or in, you know, institutions, that they're deciding the lives of these people and how they're going to, you know, live in these spaces in the future. But actually that their voice needs to be shared and get that out there. So hopefully that I have done that. Although in my work, it's been quite hard to speak to a lot of people, because each interview I have done on my field work, it takes a long time to write it up and analyze it and look for the themes in that and then bring it all together. So it's very time consuming, but I hope I have a representative sample now from speaking to people from, you know, Mount Dillon in County Longford, and speaking to people in the Littleton group of bogs in North Tipperary. So I went across the Midlands, I went over to Kildare as well. And, you know, Offaly, I was on Offaly an awful lot, which is, I really like Offaly. It was a really lovely place to do my, I guess, focus my field work, because that's where Borna Mona really, it's the heartland of Borna Mona.
And I suppose, Jamie, when I found out about you and what interested me was, I suppose, your attitudes towards it, particularly as someone who didn't grow up here in the Midlands. And I think, depending on who you speak to, I think there can be some who believe that the politicians up in Dublin are completely and utterly disconnected, and they think that the rural Ireland is some kind of Hollywood script, that they're in no way connected to the reality on the ground. There are others who will disagree with that. I suppose, hand on heart, I am born and bred an Offaly woman and proud of it. And while as a household, we didn't cut turf ourselves, all my aunts, uncles, grandparents did. We would, and still to this day, every winter would get a bag or two of turf into the garage. Okay. And I can see, I suppose, I'm very much in people. There was a presenter that used to be in Midlands 103 for a very long time by the name of Anne-Marie Kelly, who used to always give out to me about being on the fence. But it is an issue where I am completely and utterly divided, because I look at the bogs and I've done artwork around Loch Borra, and it's part and parcel of me. And when I'm stressed, I head out to Loch Borra and I just need to feel the land under my feet, and it calms me down. And that's where I go to just... that's my zen moment, for want of a better way of putting it. Anytime I drive home from Dublin, I see the beauty of it. Even along the M6 motorway, you know, you're looking out across the boglands and the countryside, and just, it makes me smile every single time I see it. But we know that the bogs contain carbon. They mine the carbon for us. We need it. We accept that climate change is a reality. And I'm loath to say that, you know what, you know, we have to get rid of the turf cutting and all of that, because it's so much part of the culture. Even just the smell of a turf fire is unique to Ireland. So I'm really interested to hear what kind of stories you got from people through your research.
Yeah, so just on the first point, I'm from rural West Cork. Despite my very Huguenot name, Breton name, so people think that I'm from outside of Ireland sometimes, and then I turn up with my West Cork accent and they're kind of surprised. So I am rural, but I've been living in Dublin for quite a while too. So people go, he's from Dublin, he doesn't understand rural issues. But I grew up in West Cork, like I say, and I would have a foot in both camps, is the best way of putting it. Now, having not been from the Midlands does give me a level of objectivity in how I look at things. So whilst I have that rural background, I'm not a Midlander. So coming in there, I have a fresh perspective. Whilst I am an environmentalist, and you know, like I said at the beginning, I have been inspired by environmental thought. The politics around environment is something that I have an academic interest in. So, like in a single sentence, my own work, I'm interested in land use change and the politics around that. So when we say politics, we don't just mean about voting once every 5 years. We actually mean about the challenges around that you describe, the contested narratives, the feeling that I have this connection to these lands, but also I understand there's actually this conflict between, on one hand, me thinking about these wonderful places I like to take a walk in and visit and want to protect, on the other hand, I'm cutting them and taking turf out of them. And I suppose the challenge that we have now in Ireland is, what I see is we are quite used with bogs being around, and we sort of take them for granted, but they're very rare habitats at an international level. And as you mentioned, they're basically 100% carbon. So there's lots of water. When the water's taken out of the bog, you know, the lifeblood of the bog, you're basically left with carbon, because that's what it is. It's plant matter that's absorbed carbon, and then it has basically died, hasn't decayed, and it's remained. So these are huge carbon sinks. And many people now will be very aware of the carbon qualities of the bog, but also the biodiversity aspects. Increasingly, the tourism aspect of the bog is coming to the fore. And for someone from the city that lives in the city, that's, you know, used with spending other time in a car or in an office, or, you know, the Lewis up here in Dublin, getting down to the countryside and spending time in bogs is a real treat. And, you know, you've seen the emergence of these greenways where people can take a bicycle, and these have, you know, the tourism opportunities are very, very obvious. But I suppose it's about bringing investment into the Midlands. And this is where just transition comes in. We need to see reinvestment in the Midlands. And there's going to be quite a significant amount of investment coming into the Midlands now, of about 170 million between the Irish government and the EU. We'll be looking at about 170 million being injected into just transition, after about 30 million has been injected already.
Jamie, we've mentioned just transition a couple of times now, so I think maybe let's take a short break for some advertisements to pay the bills, and we will be back with Jamie Rowe-Hugh to discuss this term and what the vision for just transition looks like. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and tonight we are joined by PhD candidate Jamie Rowe-Hugh, who is studying and investigating just transitions in the bogs and what exactly that means. So, Jamie, we've mentioned this idea of just transition a couple of times now. And look, I'll be honest here, communications coaching is my business outside of here. And I'm not so sure that perhaps we in the media, but definitely the political classes, have done a good job of explaining what exactly just transition will look like. Yes, we've had bits and pieces written about it and conversations and all of that. But what do you, after spending all of these years now studying and researching it, what does it look like to you, do you think?
So like a lot of these terms that you'd hear, like sustainability, there isn't really a definition of it. These terms can be used in all sorts of contexts, correctly and incorrectly. And so like sustainable and sustainable development, just transition has been used and extended to various different areas over the last while. And there really isn't a universal definition of just transition. Now, where it comes from is the trade union movement. So it has its roots in North America, where you had workers who were leaving, or what they're called, sunset industries, maybe a coal or oil plant that was closing down, was no longer economically viable. And these people were losing their jobs. They were, I guess, taking the hit, a bit like the Bordemona workers, from the closing of these industries. And then you had a case of what you do with all these people in these towns. And, you know, listeners will be familiar with the Rust Belt in North America. All of a sudden, industry closes and the place is deserted. Now, just transition for Bordemona workers, I mean, down to the years, a Bordemona worker who was let go was given a redundancy package, and they were wished well and off they'd go. And that was that. There's an increasing understanding now that a package doesn't really deal with the long-term consequences of job loss. So you might give a person 60,000 euros, which is a big windfall for many people. They might get a new car, they might send their children to university. But in the long run, it's going to impact that person's livelihood, redundancy. So thinking about how can we do things a little bit fairer? How can we give these people a new job? And so just transition is about giving someone a job that is, they were working in an area that was unsustainable, and now they're giving someone a job in an area that is sustainable. So, for example, a Bordemona worker might have been cutting and harvesting peat, and now you give them a job where they're instead, you know, cutting and harvesting a crop that's sustainable. For example, they might be doing some work on trees, or, you know, like working with Quilcha maybe, or doing retrofitting in the houses as well. You know, that was a big idea. They would get these individuals retrained and they would fit insulation. But of course, this doesn't suit some people. Now, just transition.
That's
has evolved.
Just it. You can't make an assumption, yes, that, do you know what? We don't need you to work the bog anymore, but we do need you to retrofit homes. That doesn't mean that Johnny or Mary is interested in doing that kind,
exactly,
of work.
it also extends into communities as well. So the idea of just transition at the moment, they're thinking that it's not just about the workers, but also about the communities. For example, the local filling station near the Border Mona briquette factory or near the ESB power station. What's going to happen to the shopkeeper there whenever the passing traffic stops? So, for example, in some of my field work, I would have interviewed shopkeepers who would have known when the shifts began and ended in the power station. So they would know, okay, 8 o'clock, that's when Michael, Tom and Anne-Marie are coming out and they'll be in for their newspaper and a bottle of Coke. And they'll, you know, be back maybe the next day and they'll have, you know, they'll know their orders. So what happens, that kind of business? So the community is really, really important. And my work, I'm thinking as well about the land itself. So I'm a human geographer. I have an interest in the environment. So I've been thinking about the bogs themselves and what is going to happen to all that land. Now, the good news and the bad news. The good news is that we're going to have about 80,000 hectares of Border Mona land. And they used to say it was like the size of the County Louth coming out of production. And, you know, we could use it for agriculture. That's not viable, economically viable in many ways. So what are you going to do with that land? So at the moment, some of it is going to be earmarked for wind farming. Some of it, we don't know what's going to happen. I'll be straight with you. I don't know. I study it. We're yet to know what's really going to happen on this land. But about 32,000 hectares is an enhanced rehabilitation. So these areas are going to be full of swans and peregrine falcons and squirrels and badgers, you know, in the years ahead. So it's going to boost our biodiversity. Which is a big crisis at the moment, as our wildlife is in serious trouble. So we're going to have all this space, but how do we, I guess, improve livelihoods, the livelihoods that used to be there? How do we make them better? And, you know, a bog that has a lot of wildlife on it is really, really important for our nature conservation goals, our sustainable development goals. But for people who need to pay a mortgage, how are we going to value that and you know, make a living out of that for the people that were once dependent on those spaces? So I think about that a lot. And of course, like I said, tourism is an idea. But the truth is, we're never really going to replace those jobs that were there in the ESB power stations and in Border Mona. We're not going to replace those jobs in tourism. We're not going to replace those jobs re-wetting the bogs. And there has been some workers brought back to work on damming up drains and things and making these bogs damp again and letting natural recolonization take hold. Those jobs are for 2 to 3 years and then they're over. So we have to start thinking about this. Now, the Just Transition Commissioner, Ciarán Mulvey, has published 4 reports on this and has made suggestions, and there is development happening. But there is a big conversation to be had on what Just Transition means, and there is more research that needs to be done. There needs to be a lot more people like me out there speaking to people on the ground and thinking about what people want and what can be done realistically. You know, you can have a lot of investment come in and only get 2 jobs out of it. And there could be significant investment coming in. There needs to be a broader strategy, a big picture thinking about redeveloping the Midlands more generally and how we position the Midlands in the 21st century.
Well, I 100% agree with you. And I think much of what you're talking about there is what's not been discussed nationally or at a national level, in that, you know, the bogs are about more than just the peat. They're about the community around them, the community that has been there for hundreds of years. Like, if I think of the bog nearby where my father grew up and his brother has looked into, and I know there's been a Rourke's on that land since such and such a year, you know, and I genuinely feel a connection to my family when I'm there. And I go there to feel that connection at times. And there is a fear that I have, and I think others have, in the region, and I don't know if it's unfounded or not, that if we see these areas developed as tourist destinations, even if they don't replace all the jobs, but at least to create some, that we might run into gentrification of the bogs. And next thing, all of a sudden, we've got litter problems. We've got, you know, all of a sudden, we're having to pay extortionate parking fees to visit the bog down the road that's been there for thousands of years. Did any of that come up in your research?
So it has. Lochbore Discovery Park, there's a fee there to pay for access, and the locals, I've been told, know where to park, that they don't have to pay that fee. And it isn't right. It's not just transition to tell people that maybe work in that bog. Well, if you want to visit it now, you're going to have to pay to access it. On the other hand, there wouldn't be a Lochbore without some money going into it. And, you know, Bordbona have the challenge of funding that park. And it is expensive to put in the paths, and it is expensive to have the grass cut and to put up the signage and all that, and that wears out. And Bordamona has funded it through, you know, corporate social responsibility, and there's a couple of small businesses there. So it is expensive to keep these things going. So that's the problem. But at the same time, asking, as I said, the locals to pay for it, you know, there has to be a balance struck there. Funnily enough, a lot of people coming to visit it have no problem paying at all for it. They think the €3 or the €5 or whatever it is isn't too expensive. And they're used with paying for, you know, if you go to the Dundrum Shopping Centre, the parking in there can be extortionate if you're there for 3 or 4 hours.
In fairness, and not just to call out Dundrum. Not just Dundrum. Any city centre car park. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
they can be expensive.
And I'm guilty of that myself, I have to admit. Don't think twice about paying for a city centre car park.
I know, they're even more expensive. So you can think about what people are used with. And in rural Ireland, asking people to access their own countryside and paying for it isn't really in the spirit of what Just Transition is all about. But then, of course, like I said, you have to think about how much it costs to run these places. And giving people access is really important, but how much access do you want to give? And again, this was the discussion I had down below in the Lochbore. How many people do you want to visit it? Because the more come, the more expensive it is. If you have a boardwalk, for example, going into a bog, if a lot of people come in to visit it, a lot of walking on it, that might need replaced after a while. And then there's environmental degradation that happens when these things get, you know, too much damage on them and then have to be replaced. So there's a lot to consider. The Hidden Heartlands is a really interesting kind of branding. You know, the way the Atlantic Coast has been marketed has been quite successful. The Wild Atlantic Way, as they call it. And the Hidden Heartlands, I think, would be really nice to see leveraged and extended. The problem that I found, and the people I spoke to, there's a lack of accommodation in the Midlands, and there's a lack of access. So if you don't drive a car, so if you're from Dublin or Limerick or Cork and you're used to jumping on the bus, mm-hmm. and you want to access the Hidden Heartlands, the transport situation, you know, if you don't have, a lot of people have cars, you know, in rural Ireland, they need cars. They don't have access to that if you're coming on the train and, you know, you want to get down to Lochbore. So there's access issues. If you want to stay a night or two down there, there's a lack of a hotel. Now, I know there is some development taking place now. And I've always thought that glamorous camping, glamping would be wonderful down there. And I would love to stay down there and have a sort of a rural camping experience in that, because I love Offaly, as I mentioned earlier. I love the space, and people who live in Offaly might be used with that space. But when you walk out in the bog and you see the sky, mm-hmm. and it's so flat, I absolutely love that. So, you know, living in an urban area and then coming and experiencing that, there is that tourism potential there and that amenity and access, but it does come at a cost. And how do you monetize that? And should we monetize that? And those are the debates we must have around the Midlands. You know, how do we value them and revalue them? And should there be a payment for people to preserve bogs for the carbon that's there? So these are other debates that are happening too. So I don't always like to talk about monetizing things. You know, the bog should exist in many ways for just itself. And when we start talking about money and how do we make money out of it, you know, it becomes a little bit, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with this idea of too much capitalism in the bogs, you know, and they should be valued for their own existence in many ways. And, you know, the connections we get, the social and emotional connections that you described when you talk about going to your family, but it might be necessary for us to think about how can we actually preserve those bogs and give people that livelihood. So if a farmer, for example, has a bit of bog land and they're going to let it go wet to preserve the carbon, should that farmer receive a payment? I argue they should. Other people might say, you know, who's going to pay for that? Where is that coming from? So those are the types of conversations we need to be had about the Midlands that aren't being had yet.
Well, Jamie Rohue, thank you so much for joining me on Let's Go Green this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And I think you're right. I think there's a much wider conversation needed. And I hope that we here on Let's Go Green will be doing just that around the Midlands. And the bogs are much more than turf and turf cutting. So it's been a pleasure chatting with you and getting a West Cork insight into the boglands of the Midlands.
Thank you very much, Ashley. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
Stay tuned, folks. We'll have some music after the break. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I hope you have been enjoying our programme so far this evening. And continuing with our theme of the boglands of the Midlands, we are joined now by Offaly photographer Tina Claffey. Tina, welcome to Let's Go Green.
Thanks so much, Aisling. Lovely to be here.
Now, Tina, you have developed a name for yourself as somebody who your work is focused entirely on the minute detail of the bogs here in the Midlands. And you are this month launching your brand new publication portal. It must be a very exciting time for you.
Oh, very exciting time. A lot of work has gone into this new book, which I'm really excited about. Its name is Portal, and it really, Portal being kind of a take on Purthock being bog, and also Portal being kind of an entry into, or a portal to another world, really, with my macro lens. The macro lens is the portal that helps me to see this other world within the carpet of the bog.
And for people who are not photographers, because I know you and I have spoken before, a macro lens is the kind of lens, it's almost like a microscope attached to a camera. It allows you to get really close in.
Yeah, it's the nearest thing to having like a magnifying glass, really. It allows me to capture flora and fauna that you could easily just pass by and not see at all. Really, really tiny little flora and fauna that are just exquisite, really, when viewed up close.
At this time of year, you know, as you drive anywhere really near a bog in the Midlands, the colours are just so vibrant and beautiful. So it seems appropriate that this is the time of year that you're launching the book. So I'm wondering, you know, for people who haven't heard about you before, how did this all start for you?
Oh, God, it's a long, winding story. But I lived in Africa for a long time, for about 9 years. And that was in Botswana. So I was living in kind of pristine wilderness areas. And that's where my love of nature photography began. And then in 2011, I came back to Ireland and I came back to Burr. And it was a bit of a anticlimax coming back to Burr as from living out there in Africa. But I went for a walk with John Feehan, botanist and geologist. And it was only a small little group of us out for a walk in our local bog, Killawn Bog. And he gave each of us a tiny little hand lens, which is like a little magnifying glass. And as he walked and talked, he was encouraging us to look through the flora, look at the flora and fauna he was handing us through this hand lens. And it really kind of changed the course of my life, really. it completely blew me away what I was looking at, because I would have walked by it and not even noticed. And I really understood on that day that there was a wilderness, almost just as important as the wilderness where I lived in Africa, but right here on my doorstep. So that started the whole idea of macro photography for me. I went back to that bog the very next day, and I had to purchase a macro lens because I couldn't take photos with the lenses I had. Mm-hmm. So I invested in a macro lens, and that's what got me started. Then I started to literally fall into like Alice falling into the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland, because there's so much out there. You could sit in one little area and take a photo of something and then swivel the lens a tiny bit and you notice something else, and then you notice something else. And so that, like, the whole carpet was alive, a living carpet on the bog. And that's what I've fallen in love with, really. And that's what I'm trying to celebrate in this book. So it's a visual journey, really, through the seasons. of the flora and fauna that you'll find within the bogs, within the wetlands, and within the esker dry areas as well. So it's kind of an immersive visual exploration within the bog.
So Tina, this has been your work, your passion since 2011, 11 years now. And I'm thinking back to school tours to the bogs and being shown, you know, how to cut turf. That was kind of it. Maybe being shown, you know, different types of heather. And now I move forward to where we are very aware of what the bogs do for us. And I think young children are learning more and more. Have attitudes changed, do you think? Or are people maybe appreciating your work more now than they might have done when you started?
Oh, I think attitudes have hugely changed, and which is such a great thing. I always thought of the bog as a child. I always thought of the bog really as a dead landscape, something that was to be used, to be harvested. It's attitudes have changed really for the better. I mean, there's so many bogs now and that have boardwalks put in there so people can immerse themselves. They can walk out into the bog and totally immerse themselves in nature. And sure, the bogs are so important. You know, they've realized now how important they are. They really are our rainforests. They absorb so much carbon. But what I try to do is I just try to, in a visual way, help people appreciate what we have. We have amazing wildernesses out there. So that's what I try to convey and promote the conservation of them, of what we have left.
In the 11 years that you have been documenting the bogs, have you seen changes in the landscape?
I have. Definitely there have been bogs that I was going to from the start that are drying out more, that would have been cut, or part of them have been cut. So it's like a balloon with a little pinprick in it, and the water is receding. But having said that, there are other bogs that I've visited that are being conserved now, and that you can see them getting wetter and wetter. And that's what you want in a bog. You want it to be really wet. There's pluses and minuses, but hopefully it's all heading in the right direction now. I like to think so anyway, because they're a very important wilderness. We have some of the most pristine bogs in the whole of Europe, so they're really worth preserving. And I think people are definitely more aware of that now and are striving to look after them.
So when people look at your photography, and I should say is it Tina Claffey on Instagram? Your Instagram account is...
Instagram is Tina Claffey, yeah.
Tina Claffey, I forget the Instagram handle, but the Instagram account is beautiful. So if you're not familiar with Tina's work, go on to Instagram and look up Tina Claffey. It is absolutely stunning. And what always strikes me is the amount of colour in your images, because I think we tend to think of bogs as being brown.
Well, absolutely. I never would have considered colour in the bog other than when the heather comes into bloom in the autumn. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I would have thought of it as a brown mass of landscape, but it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, the sphagnum mosses alone it's like a kaleidoscope of colour. They come in every shade, from reds to oranges to greens to almost purple in some cases. There's so much colour out there. You have devil's matchstick, which is a tiny little lichen with a scarlet red tip. You have the sundews, which catch the insects, and they are, again, a kaleidoscope of colour. These beautiful, beautiful miniature little flycatchers. There's so much out there. And it's only when you slow down and really look that you will see them. And the macro photography also forces me to slow down that ever bit further, because I'm basically lying down in the bog to get the photograph, because everything's on the ground. So I have to lie down for stability as well for the camera to get the shot. So I literally, I'm almost meditating out there. I'm moving like a sloth through the bog. But I love it. I'm still finding new things. So like, I mean, it's incredible out there.
Photography is a an art form that has become so much more accessible with smartphones in the last decade or so. So if there's somebody listening to us this evening and interested maybe in, you know, practicing or learning more about photography and like the bog is nearby, what advice would you give to them?
Oh, it's for me, the best camera you have is the one that is in your pocket or the one that you carry around with you. The best camera you have is the one that you can, is like a glove, that it's easy to use, you know. Lenses, I mean, if you're going in a more professional way, the lenses are the most important. But I mean, for phones, you can get these amazing attachments that you can take macro photography with as well. And they're really incredible. I mean, the technology just gets better and better. I'm kind of old school. I'm out with the old camera, and I'm obviously digital, not the old slides. That's what I enjoy. But I mean, you know, to go out there with your phone is just, as long as you can slow down and really see. So that's what it's all about, is looking at things differently and looking at things up close and really appreciating them.
So then, what would you like people to take away from your new book, Portal?
I suppose, as I say, my book is about raising awareness about how beautiful that living carpet of the bog is. It's a visual journey through the seasons. And if it inspires one person to go out onto a boardwalk and maybe step off that boardwalk and sit in there among the mosses and those wondrous things out there, that I'd be happy, you know, if one person does that, because it really, I just want people to appreciate what we have on our doorsteps. And that's about it, really. My book is it's called Portal, but it's Otherworldly Wonders of the Bogs, Wetlands and Eskers. And it is otherworldly out there. If you take the time and you slow down and you look closely, it is otherworldly. And that's really what I want to show in the book and help people appreciate what we have.
Well, Tina Claffey, it has been a pleasure to speak with you once again this evening, and make sure and look up at Tina's work. Tina, where can people get a copy of the book, by the way?
It'll be in all good bookshops, but you'll also find it, you can get it directly from corkbooks.com. So Cork Books are the publishers, so that's corkbooks.com. You can also go onto my website, tinaclaffey.com, and you'll be able to purchase the book through my website as well.
Well, Tina, thank you so much for chatting with us on Let's Go Green this evening. We will be back for the final part of the programme just after these ads. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I'm Aisling O'Rourke, your host. Well, we are running short on time this evening once again, but before I hand you over, thank you very much for listening. Please do get in contact if you'd like to be featured here on the programme. The email once again is letsgogreen@midlands103.com. Now, I'm going to leave you tonight with a new song to me, but one I think I really like. It's Abby Butler and Deja Vu. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you soon.